It's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Casey Hayes, who is professor of biology and nutrition at Brandeis University, where he teaches basic courses in human physiology as well as diet and health. He is also director of the Foster Biomedical Research Laboratory and University Animal Facility, and the author or co-author of more than 200 publications in the area of nutrition and health, most focused on dietary fat, lipid metabolism, and atherosclerosis in animal models. More recently, with several patents, he has attempted to bring science to practical applications through products that apply to everyday living, including the popular spread Smart Balance, which is one of the sponsors of the symposium, and phytosterol supplemented foods that reduce plasma cholesterol levels. His current research currently focuses on nutritional control of obesity and diabetes. And Dr. Hayes's presentation will be on dietary fat, fatty acids, and triglyceride structure implications for human lipoproteins. Casey?
Thank you, Don, and thank Wayne State and Pramod Khosla for setting up this very interesting symposium and for the invitation to be here. What I'd like to do is go back over 40 years of looking at lipids, started at Harvard School of Public Health with Mark Hegstead. We've heard about him here today. And in the beginning, I used to think about fat, and then about 20 years ago, I realized it wasn't fat, stupid, it's fatty acids. And now, as you just heard from Sundram, it's not fatty acids, it's structure. So I'm going to try and touch a little bit on that and show you why we've come to some of the conclusions we have. First of all, let's just do some basic homework together. I want to make sure that we all are talking the same language because it's not always easy. If you read, for instance, the nutrition label, it says saturated fat. They don't really mean saturated fat. They're talking about the fatty acid content of relative fats and their relative concentrations of fatty acids. So it's saturated fatty acids, and it's trans fatty acids, and it's polyunsaturated fatty acids. That's still in the current literature. People still talk about saturated fat because that's what the public sort of knows about. But you and I know differently today that it's more complicated. So what do? The important form of food that we eat is a triglyceride. And as Sundram pointed out, it has an interesting and important structure. It has a 3-carbon glycerol with 3 fatty acids off it, SN1, SN2, SN3. And then it has the fatty acids that placed on these carbon glycerol bonds. The other form of fatty acid that we consume actually is are the fatty acids in phospholipids. And this is, we haven't talked about it today, but this is where the action is. This is why certain fats lower cholesterol. It's not because saturated fats do something magic. It's because saturated fats don't have enough polyunsaturates to make phospholipids. And phospholipids are what make membranes work and receptors work and lower cholesterol, et cetera, in a simplistic sort of way. So be aware that when we look at a bottle of oil, soybean oil, you're talking about triglycerides, but you know that inside there are fatty acids. And in soybean oil, there are no, I'm going to say it, but there are probably no triglyceride droplets that have all three of the fatty acids the same. One might be saturated, one might be mono, and one might be poly. But in soybean oil, it tends to be two very often are polyunsaturated, and one of them is saturated, or one of them is unsaturated. That was referenced this morning in one of the questions. So structure is important, and the fatty acids in the triglyceride are important. And then there are more sophisticated lipids as well that contain fatty acids, and they're very important in signaling, cell signals and how the brain works, et cetera, et cetera. So we haven't even really touched on that. We're all focused on lipoproteins or diabetes because we have measurable endpoints that are relatively easily done, and a lot of people can do them. So what about looking now then at fats? It's helpful, at least for my students, to point out that we eat a lot of different fats, all the way from a safflower oil here with all its polyunsaturated fatty acids as a class, and very few saturated fatty acids and rather few monounsaturated fatty acids. And as we progress across these vegetable oils, we come to sort of a break point here, And we think of lard as a saturated fat, but notice that it has a lot less saturated fatty acid content than coconut oil, which is much harder at room temperature than lard. And the reason is it has more saturated fats, fatty acids that can pack into the molecules and pack the oil much tighter. Over here, we have the average American diet, which I'll refer to a couple of times today. And you can see that it is unlike any original fat in nature. There's nothing that has quite this structure, partly because of the trans fatty acid that's in that diet. You can see that milk products, beef tallow and milk fat, have some, but basically it's a little different. And it has quite a bit more polyunsaturated fatty acids than almost half, more than half, of the fats that we consider as saturated fat. So this is the problem. And it is pointed out more carefully and more definitively on this slide, where we look at these same fats, but now look at the fatty acids involved. And I'll tell you the punchline today is that saturated fat or saturated fatty acids are the problem in a saturated fat, because not because they're there in number, but because there's not enough polys. Polyunsaturated fatty acids, 18-2 really is the workhorse, linoleic acid, is what drives lipid metabolism in the body. And without enough polyunsaturated fatty acids in the diet, you see all sorts of strange things in response to specific saturated fats or their fatty acids. And as Sundram pointed out, we learned sort of the hard way. We used to do regression analyses too, and we said, oh, 14-0 is the bad fat, the fatty acid. It must be myristic acid. Well, it turns out if you feed myristic acid, which we've done to gerbils, and you put it in blends as salts or whatever, myristic acid doesn't raise cholesterol very much at all. It's only when it's in a natural fat where these two fatty acids are linked together. And the reason that that happens is because there's not enough polyunsaturates to work the machinery. And I'll show you that in an experiment in just a second. Here's for your notebooks, just the titles, the names of all the fatty acids. You can go back and look them up in a hurry and keep them as a reference. As I point out, there are really only two major fatty acids that we consume in bulk. That's palmitic acid and oleic acid. Every bite you eat, everything you eat, plants or vegetables, have these two fatty acids there. They're the fatty acids that your liver makes. We heard that this morning. They're not toxic. They're not bad. It's just that when we get them in the wrong structure of a triglyceride, they can play havoc. Stearic acid, rather minor. We talk a lot about that today, but it's only 2 to 4% of the energy that we consume every day, whereas palmitic acid is probably up around 8 or 10% of the saturated fatty acids we consume. Linoleic acid, 15% of the total fatty acids that we consume about are linoleic acid. Adipose tissue corresponds pretty well with what we consume except for palmitic acid. We store a lot more oleic relative to palmitic and more linoleic relative to the absolute amount that we consume than we do palmitic. If we 50% of palmitic acid in our adipose tissue, I would be up here as a stiff. We wouldn't have any mobility. You have to have some flexibility, which comes with the unsaturation. Alpha-linolenic acid is obviously significant because it's one of the essential fatty acids along with linoleic acid, but it's relatively minor and it's not a big player in the lipoprotein story. And these, obviously, long-chain N3 fatty acids are very important too, but we won't get into that because they don't affect lipoprotein metabolism very much. Now, speaking of Hegsted, McGandy, Harvard School of Public Health, 1970, they did studies in the 60s that were really quite interesting. Hegsted had a population at an institution, a mental institution, where he went in and worked with the cooks And they just kept changing the fat for 4 years on these people, same 19 or 20 men. And he had a remarkable experimentation procedure that he followed, and he found some very interesting things. Now, I'm going to show you a few slides today that are set up like this. I show you the fatty acids of the diet that was fed, the fat in the diet that was fed, and then I show you the lipoprotein response. Here you can see the total cholesterol very quickly at the top, the LDL in red, and the HDL in this orange color. So if you look at the average American diet, and here I have the SMP ratio, saturated fatty acids to monounsaturated to polyunsaturated fatty acid ratio, percent energy, it should add up to the total, which is about 38%. Then we have the average American diet back then was 6% energy from polys, not much changed. Notice how high the percent energy from saturated fatty acids was. Relatively high, much higher than now, almost twice as high. And then he fed, put olive oil in for the fat, or he put MCT, medium chain triglyceride, which was basically 10-0 fatty acid, almost in total. Notice how small the polyunsaturated, there's no polys in that diet really, except came from the food. And safflower oil, notice how large the component, 26% energy from polys. And then he fed butter as his sort of pure saturated fat. Again, notice how over 50% of all the fatty acids now are saturated, and there's a pretty good slug of stearic acid and quite a large amount of palmitic and then 14-0 myristic. And look what happened to the cholesterol. The average American diet, 220. So these are moderately cholesterolemic men, about 50 years old. And olive oil, no significant change. It makes the point that when you're in trouble, if you have a hypercholesterolemia to begin with, then don't try and correct it with monounsaturated fat. It doesn't work. You need to have polys. And that's shown over here very dramatically. When we got the polys up this high, look how far the cholesterol dropped. That's a very large amount, down to 180 from 220. But unfortunately, we're having a slippage in the HDL. It went down too. LDL very nicely down, and the LDL-HDL ratio, which I put between the columns here on all my slides, is now significantly improved over the values that are here. On the other hand, look what happened when he fed butter fat. Total cholesterol shot up to 254, LDL to 196, and we didn't get much of a boost in HDL. In fact, it went down even more than safflower oil. And the LDL-HDL ratio, which I still like to use from my old experimental days when I used to quantitate atherosclerosis in monkeys, this was the best fix, the best ratio of prediction. It still works pretty well in humans, as we heard from Dr. Bauer this morning, but TC and over HDL is widely used now too. So you can see that saturated fats are a problem, but look at how small the polys are here. So polyunsaturated fat, for sure, and fatty acid component in that fat were the ones that do the best. So that's where we got the idea 60 years ago that feed saturated fat and your cholesterol goes up, for sure. The bad cholesterol goes up, for sure. They didn't know much about LDL, HDL then. In fact, I had to play with some numbers in this paper to get these numbers out, but he reported the old way of doing lipoproteins with beta lipoprotein and alpha lipoprotein on electrophoresis, et cetera, et cetera. So you could calculate these numbers. When you do that, you get this kind of result. MCTs, notice what they did without any real saturated fats or other fatty acids to speak of. Look what happened to HDL. It dropped the bottom out from 52 down to 40. So as Sundam pointed out in his talk, there's something about putting in saturated fatty acids and palmitic acid particularly that has a potential for raising HDL relative to it not being there, or even to a poly or certainly an MCT. Okay, so look at that. And remember then that the body keeps track of fatty acids and not the fat per se. The number of fatty acids consumed, so that's the total fat, and we sort of made reference to that, from 25 to 30 to 35, the higher the fat content, the higher the cholesterol tends to go. When you go to carbohydrate, to tie into another talk, and take the fat out, the cholesterol may drop, but the VLDL and the triglycerides go very high, and the HDL goes down. So you have a dysfunction in the lipoproteins there. Chain length is important. So we're going to focus on 12, 14, 16, and 18 now. The unsaturation to saturation ratio, the P to S ratio, I still like to use as the quickest way of assessing what your diet is like. So as a dietitian, you get that information and you quickly do the calculations or put it into a computer, like my tracker on my pyramid at USDA, and it'll tell you what the P to S ratio is. And I'll tell you right now, the bottom line here is that it wants to be close to one. And I'll show you why that seems to work. And the fatty acid position on the triglyceride molecule, I think, is quite important. So let's consider the intake and balance among the dietary fatty acids. And in order to get the balance and to get fatty acid metabolism to go correctly, it's largely 18-2-N6, linoleic acid, that we need to focus on. That's not to say that N3 PUFAs are not important in heart disease. They are. They're very important. We know that they affect immune cell function, platelet aggregation, thrombosis, endothelial relaxation, cardiac arrhythmias. These are all attributed to the long-chain PUFA. But that's not our focus right now. We want to talk about saturated fat and how to control the lipemia that goes with it. And this is the only fatty acid that does that. And this is why we're interested in that. This is a cartoon I developed a few years ago. And basically, the real concern is getting the LDL too high from saturated fat feeding. We've seen that this morning and we talked about it. When this gets too high, LDL, and if the particles get small and dense, they oxidize readily, and it is very atherogenic. It damages the arterial wall. There's only one fatty acid, really, that opens or encourages the LDL receptor activity, and that is 18-2. That's why I think the polyunsaturates have the major effect here. Now, 18-2 also reduces VLDL output. Triglyceride synthesis goes down. It goes down with 18-2. It goes down even more with long-chain polyunsaturates when you get grams of them, not necessarily 100 milligrams or 200 milligrams a day that we more or less require. But if you give enough polys, this goes down too. So we slow down the production of VLDL, and we put a lesser burden on the clearance of VLDL. And one of the burdens, to tie in again with Dr. Volek's talk, insulin is very important for fatty acid clearance and triglyceride clearance from the VLDL. It activates lipoprotein lipase, which is the enzyme that does this. So without enough insulin or with this pathway damaged at all by insulin's inactivity, then we have a problem. VLDL backs up. Carbohydrate is putting out maximal amount of VLDL. Now, the breakdown of VLDL is important. You do want some because you'll notice that a good portion of the HDL production comes from the surface coat of VLDL and the production of HDL. So this is important to have. But at the same time, we produce the end product of this also as LDL, and we don't want much of that. 18-2 also increases bile acid synthesis, which uses up cholesterol, moves it out into biliary cholesterol and down into the gut. So we get cholesterol out of the liver, and this block by cholesterol on the LDL receptor is removed. So fatty acids are important in a lot of different places in this profile, and that's why they've been focused on quite a bit over the years. Now, here's an experiment that we ran many years ago, but it still tells a big story. And that is the gerbil, which I like to use because, to my knowledge, it's the most sensitive species on Earth to feeding fat and looking at a cholesterol response. What this study shows is that if you put a purified diet, excuse me, with pure coconut oval here, with a little poly so they don't get essential fatty acid deficient, the cholesterol goes almost to 200. That's all I did. There's no cholesterol in this diet. If I move them over to pure safflower oil, look at it, dropped to 74. Almost a threefold difference just by changing the type of fat. So you can see very clearly from an experiment like this that saturated fat can surely raise cholesterol. And notice there's a triple or quadruple increase in the LDL by doing that. So yes, you can lower bad LDL cholesterol by putting in polyunsaturates. But the reason I show this slide is because as I blended pure coconut oil in the ratio of 5:1 here with safflower oil, or 1 to 1.5 safflower oil, etc., finally 1 to 20 parts safflower oil, notice what happened. The cholesterol drops. And the point I'd like to make is that the action is all over. By the time I get around a ratio, a P to S ratio of about 1 to 1.5, I've lowered the cholesterol about as far as I can go. And it doesn't go down forever. It doesn't, it's not linear for all the way out here. So it's a nonlinear, and we looked at that in our monkey data and our gerbil data and our hamster data, and we came up with a working model of this. Kosla was in my lab at this time, and we actually came up with what we call the 18:2:6 threshold. And in simple terms, it says you need a certain amount of 18:2. It's roughly in this range in the human diet in the world, about 3% energy up to 6.5% energy. If you fall below your personal ratio, threshold, then saturated fat in abundance in the diet begins to raise your cholesterol. That's what I just showed you in the gerbil study. And if I put enough polyunsaturates in to counteract the coconut oil in the gerbil study, then the cholesterol comes down. So it tells me right away that since they were pure saturated fatty acids in coconut oil, they're not much else, and there's pure 18:2 in safflower oil, not much else, then somehow it's between those classes of fatty acids where this struggle goes on, and there's something physiological about that, and there's some control mechanism involved. And so we've worked with that, and it seems to hold pretty well. That's why I asked Sundram how much polyunsaturated 18:2 did he have in his diets, because if half of his diets had slightly less 18:2 and he could drop the right side and make it have higher 18:2, 5%, and over here there are 3%, that explains to me why the cholesterol were higher in some. Very important. Okay, so threshold is important. Then there's some interesting data that came from the Netherlands. Krumhout did a very interesting epidemiologic follow-up to the 7-country study we heard about this morning from Dr. Feynman. And here, I didn't look at all the variables here, but he went to these villages 25 years later. He looked at the coronary heart disease mortality 25 years after Keyes had then been there. And he asked the old ladies in the village to cook the meals the same way they did 25 years ago. He took those meals back to his lab. He extracted them and analyzed them for fat, protein, and carbs, and fatty acids, and he published all that. And I simply made a cartoon out of it, a figure, and I plotted his mortality figure against the P-to-S ratio, really. You could add 16:0 on here, and it didn't change much. So it's really, again, showing you the same data. Now there's an endpoint, death. You can't get much ender than that. It shows you an endpoint that fits again with the P to S ratio and saturated fatty acids versus the amount of polys in the diet. So with that, then we can say, so if saturated fatty acids are bad, why not remove them from the diet? And I think Dr. McNamara referred to this study this morning, the Delta study. It was done. American Heart Association behind it with Henry Ginsberg and Penny Chrysetherton. They did a really nice study. I think it was in 5 centers around the U.S., about 100 people. And they took the average American diet, and here you can see the percent energy fat, and here's my SMP, saturated percent energy, mono and polys, and here's the P to S ratio. And they wanted to remove, in steps, 5% energy from saturated fatty acids. Let's get rid of them and keep the monos and the polys constant. And you can see they did that pretty well. They got the first one down to 29% energy. And notice they kept the monos and the polys exactly the same. And it was all 6% energy came out of the sats. And they got a significant drop in total cholesterol, a significant drop in LDL. But oh dear, the HDL went down too. Notice the LDL-HDL ratio didn't change. So yes, we lowered the total cholesterol, but from one perspective, we didn't really reduce the risk very much. And then they said, okay, let's drop to the step two diet, really, the low-fat diet, 25% energy. Let's get down below current recommendation, below 7% energy, keeping monos and polys the same. And look at, they did get a slight and significant decrease again, a little less decrease, but still significant in the LDL. But uh-oh, the HDL went down again. Not so good. And the LDL-HDL ratio didn't change. But all things considered, since we don't know a whole lot about HDL, as Dr. Bauer pointed out this morning, and risk, then we should probably go with a great decline here in LDL. So we tell people to lower their fat. That's where that came from. Well, we saw that, and we said, okay, we still have our cebus monkeys. Let's go back and do the delta cebus. And we did that in our monkeys. And I had the average American diet here, AH step one, step two, 25%. But when we got down to the 25% energy, step two, notice that we took saturates out. And here in this step one, we went 1:1:1, which is a true American Heart Association, the old recommendation. And that was our gold standard for years. When we went to step two, yes, we took 5% energy out, and we got to a P to S ratio of 2. You'd think that would be super. Well, just like the Delta study in humans, total cholesterol drop both times significantly in each case. The LDL drop big time in the beginning and still significant down here at AHA2. But when we got to AHA2 at 25% energy, we said, okay, let's go into a balanced situation because our previous data had already shown that this is probably a good idea. And we rebalanced 1:1:1, the old AHA, 8:8:8 at 25% energy. And notice what happened. We didn't change the total cholesterol one bit. We slightly decreased the LDL, and we got a slight but nice bump in HDL. And we had a nice decrease in the LDL-HDL ratio. So we actually improved on this. These are purified diets. Monkeys didn't have a choice, either eat or shut up. And they did, and they performed well. And then when we were down here, this was based on palm oil, we said with the saturates, 16-0 based. Let's switch it to 12 and 14 with coconut oil. Still, 8:8:8, boom, we did that, and look what happened. Total cholesterol jumped way up like AHA1. The LDL went up significantly. We did get a slight bump in HDL, but the ratio made a rather large increase, so it wasn't very good. So that goes back to what Sundram was just talking about in his paper. You can separate the classes of saturated fatty acids first in total amount, and then you can start looking at individual types by feeding fats and blending. So you compare one fatty acid exchange with two or one other, still in a natural form, and getting the response out that way. Now, just to show you that the basic concept of the AHA is still could work, there's a classic study in the literature, the Oslo study, with I think it was about 2,000 men for over several months, and they found these men with very marked hypercholesterolemia, you can see here, very high LDL-HDL ratio, and they put them on the AHA. They trained them, showed them how to eat and what to get rid of. They took out saturates, and they took down the total fat, so the monos went down, but they left the polys more or less the same. So the P-S ratio ended up being 1, just as I showed you in the Cebus monkeys, 1:1:1, P-S being 1. And look what happened. Total cholesterol dropped by almost 100 points. Big improvement in the VLDL cholesterol. Big, big improvement, 100-point drop again, all in the LDL. And the HDL actually increased. So when you have a straining system over here, and you let up on the system by improving the ratio, we think, of sats to polys and the total fat, around 30% we still believe is the best idea, although we're open to negotiation on that. I don't have a lot of data at 40% energy. It gets a little bit problematic because as you increase fat, your cholesterol does go up. But this ratio is really quite important. Now, this is one of Frank Hu's studies and from the New England Journal, the Nurses' Health Study, and I always like to say 80,000 women can't be wrong, right? So he did a very interesting, and I think we'll probably hear more from the next speaker on this, that if you do multivariate analysis and look at quintiles of intake of different kinds of fat, in this paper he was looking at fat and risk to heart disease, he showed that the lowest quintile of trans up to the highest quintile, when you go in this direction, notice that the risk for heart disease goes up in essentially all of the columns. But the important part for me of this study has always been over here in the first quintile of trans, where the trans intake is very low. Then, if you go this way, you can see what happens to risk for heart disease simply as a function of polyunsaturated fatty acid intake, or 18-2 intake, realistically, with the other saturated monofatty acids still in the pool because he hadn't factored those out yet. But here, you can see exactly what I showed you in the gerbil study. Look how this drops off precipitously, and then once you get to the highest levels of polys above the threshold for this population of nurses, the risk doesn't go down anymore. Same concept right there in the human data. And I'm sure Dr. Mozafarian will tell us a little more about that. So if you look at these data, and I think Dr. McNamara referred to this morning, or someone did, and you look at the other saturated fatty acid risk here, and he did the same thing with the quintiles of intake for saturated fatty acid, notice that the relative risk didn't change. So saturated fatty acids per se in this population couldn't be pulled out as a risk factor. And the percent energy, look at it, almost doubled across that range, still no sign of increased risk. Monounsaturated fatty acids followed the saturated fatty acids almost to a T for percent energy. Remember I told you we consume about the same amount of these two in our diet? Again, look at monos didn't reduce risk, no effect there. But if you do it for polyunsaturated fatty acids and you look at the change, you see that there's a trend which is highly significant. As you increase polys, down goes the risk. And at the end here, this is 6.68, 32% decrease in risk is significant on its own at this point. And if you look at the percent energy, remember I showed you my hypothesis for 18-2 threshold, 3% up to 6%. That's just where I showed you the sliding curve was, and this data fits very nicely. When you get up around 5, even when you start above 3, it starts to go down, the risk. But when you get 5 or 6, the risk drops out. That tells me that polys can take care of the saturated fatty acids if you give enough polys to get 1:1 ratio. Saturated fats, so the point is, are only a problem because they lack polyunsaturated fatty acids, not because they contain saturated fatty acids. So in part, I'm telling you that today our focus is misplaced. We're talking about saturated fatty acids and fat and so forth, but But we always have to talk about it in the context, how much 18-2 did you eat at the same time? And if you eat enough 18-2, forget about fatty acids as a risk factor, except for trans, as you saw in the WHO study. It's the diet PUFA content that's critical. And it's not just PUFA content, but rather the SN2 PUFA. Now, let's look at that. Sundram's already stolen my thunder, but I'll just repeat a little of it. Second, let's consider the triglyceride structure and the relative position. I don't have to review that, but here it is. Different oils have this kind of, here's what canola oil, a lot of the molecules look like this in canola oil. It's a monounsaturated. Why? Because most of its fatty acids are 18-1, but it has quite a bit of 18-2. And what nature does with her oils is almost always put a good portion of the polyunsaturates in the SN2 position. Why? Because if you go back to the phospholipid structure that I showed you, it's SN2 polyunsaturate that is the working part of the molecule. It goes to prostaglandins, it goes into lecithin in the structure of the lipids and so forth. So that's where we need to have the polyunsaturate in that position. Butter, on the other hand, and coconut oil, on the other hand, and palm kernel oil, the only three saturated fats, remember way over on the left side of my chart, they're the only three fats that if I fed all of you in this room, 90% of you, your cholesterol would go up. If I feed lard, or I feed tallow, or I feed palmoline, then it's iffy. If your cholesterol is high to begin with, then palm oil, palmitic acid has a problem. We didn't talk about that. So the host, it sets the threshold. Your threshold is much higher for 18-2 if you're sitting here with a cholesterol issue and your total LDL is elevated, etc. So when you randomize these oils, then these fatty acids can just play musical chairs, really, on the glycerol. They land wherever they can. So if you interesterify, question mark, do they behave normally in the body? And if you take two very important oils, because they're under discussion here, palm oil, it looks like this. 1 and 3, most of the molecules are 16-0 with a few 18-0. Or cocoa butter, most of the molecules are 18-0 and a few 16-0. But almost all of the molecules have a monounsaturated in the 2 position. So structure seems to be important. And if you feed, as Sundram just pointed out, you feed palmoline, which has more 18-1, slightly more than 16-0, then some of these are even 18-1, and palmoline is not very cholesterol-raising. If you take palm stearin, which is a fraction of palm oil, which is a hard fraction, quite a few of these molecules are 16-0. And you feed palm stearin to my gerbils, and their cholesterol goes up. So it's more confirmation that the SN2 saturated fatty acid is problematic. So if you interesterify with 18-0 or 16-0, trouble can result at SN2. There is evidence for that. And here's probably one of the best studies. This is from Sheila Innes' lab many years ago, about 10, 12 years ago now. And she fed infants a special lipid that was made to replace breast milk. And over here you can see breast milk's composition. And they made the fatty acid profile very similar, 46% energy in the formula, 10, 10, but breast milk didn't quite get up to 10. It was 6% energy from polys. And the formulas were the same. They used palmoline, or they made beta-pol as enzymatically, putting 16-0 in the 2 position and not in the 1-3, which is 1-3, you see, 16-0 versus SN2, 16-0. And when they fed this, very interesting, no change in total cholesterol in these infants. But look what a number it did on the LDL-HDL ratio and the profile. LDL almost doubled, HDL dropped 30%. And the ratio, the LDL-HDL ratio, increased almost doubled, essentially doubled. But look what happened to breast milk. Breast milk gave a much higher total cholesterol. The LDL was twice as high as even the interesterified beta-pol, and the HDL was intermediate. But look what happened to the LDL-HDL ratio. It was up 50% from even the worst-case scenario here. But I would remind you that breast milk has dietary cholesterol in it, in all animal fats, including milks, and 18.2 was reduced over here. And I didn't present all the evidence for this, but to metabolize more cholesterol in the body, you need more 18.2. And apparently, if you put 16.0 in the 2 position by interesterification, you need more 18.2 also to do a better job in metabolizing the LDL profile. So this combination shows very strikingly in infants what can happen. And this is important, I think. The infants are a very nice model because what they consume is in the formula. They don't have a snack and they don't sneak some potato chips at 3 in the afternoon. They take what's in the bottle. Every swallow is the same fat, the same formula, and they do it, in this case, for 6 months. And you can see that it has a major effect. Plus, they don't have any adipose reserves when they're growing. They have no 18.2 in their adipose tissues to use as reserve to compensate what's not in the diet. Now, I'd just like to point out that all saturated fats, when you look at them, and this is a single family, it's very complicated because these are all, quote, palm oil. And notice that if you take crude palm oil right out of the fruit and crush it, you get all these wonderful carotenoids and everything else. But because the American housewife doesn't like all that color in her fat, they extract it and throw away the tocotrienols and the tocopherols and the beta-carotene, and we get this nice, clean, white fat. If you take palm oil now, which is the extract here, and you warm it up and melt it and then cool it rapidly, it fractionates by dry fractionation into palm stearin, which contains the solids. You can see some of them still down here, and a liquid olein fraction, which is for all the world, as Sundram has pointed out, metabolizes like olive oil. When you put this fraction against olive oil, you can't see a difference in metabolism in humans or animals. And then if you take this fraction and do the same thing, dry distill it again, you get more liquid fraction, super palm olein, and even less solids. And as I told you, if you take this stearin fraction and you feed it to gerbils, you get a different result than if you feed palm olein. And I've done this, stearin, palm oil, and palm olein, and the cholesterol goes boop, boop, boop. And it's modest, 130, 121, 112 or something, but it's there. So again, this would be where the SN2-16O is. And then there's palm kernel. In the heart of the fruit, there is a kernel, the same way that there's a pit in an olive, and the kernel gives oil, and it has a very hard fat also. But notice its melting point is almost like an olein fraction. But this is where the 12 and 14 resides. It's not in these fractions of palm oil. So not all saturated fats are the same. And this shows you, again, the fractionation, what happens in those positions. You can check it in the book. And finally, let's just look at a couple of studies. I won't dwell on them because Sundram already talked about them, but the Judd study was, I think, the best study of the test of modified fats in the literature, and they did it very carefully. They had 50 men that they followed for 5-week periods on each of these diets, and they were very strict about how they did it. All the fats were made by the American Shortening Institute, so they were very carefully positioned. And they were designed once and for all to show that trans fatty acids was or were not bad, and that the replacement interesterified 18.0 was not bad either, or even better. And if you look at the comparison, they had a carbohydrate diet here, which was 30% fat, and they replaced the carbs with fat here to get up to 38% energy from fat. And here they replaced it with 18.1, or oleic acid. Here they replaced part of the oleic, half of it about, with trans. And here they split the increase between 18.0 and trans. And here there's all 18-0. So you can see this progression. And then they compared it with a blend of natural fats for saturated fats, largely butter, some coconut oil, some palm oil, some, I think, beef tallow. And you can see that they got the total saturates up pretty high, but they had the monos exactly the same all the way across here. Cis monos were all the same. The polys, they kept beautifully the same. 18-3 was the same. So they were looking really at the exchanges of these fatty acids. What did they find? When they came in, the total cholesterol was 183. When they put them on high oleic, no change, no significant change. It did give us the lowest LDL-HDL ratio, however. And when they put them on the trans, well known to us now, look at the jump in LDL and the decrease in HDL, very striking. And notice the LDL-HDL ratio went up. When they split it between the 18-0 and the trans, instead of going back to the norm here for cis, it's the ratio is still almost the same as the trans. And when they get over here to the pure interesterified, it's a little better on the ratio, and the total LDL is down. But notice that the HDL is no better than the trans. So here's very nice evidence that goes along with what Sundaram presented just a moment ago, that if you interesterify and put 18-0 in the 2 position, it mimics what we saw with 16-0 in the 2 position in those infants, in the infant formula. The total cholesterol may not change much, but the LDL-HDL ratio is shifting. And when you get to the natural saturated fats, the total cholesterol went up a little from carbohydrate and the high oleic, and surprisingly, the HDL went up pretty well. Maybe not surprisingly, we know saturated fat can raise HDL too. And the LDL-HDL ratio was the same as the best one over here in cis. So again, here's an argument that natural saturated fatty acids at very high levels up here, 21% of energy out of 38, that's more than half, can be compensated pretty well if you have enough polyunsaturates. And this is Sundaram's study. I won't bother on that, but Sundaram mentioned that he had run the study. We looked at insulins in those studies and glucose, and even after 2 weeks on diet, the blood glucose was elevated, and in that study, the insulins were decreasing. Up here, the insulin units were actually decreasing with interesterified as the glucose went up. What he just reported was a little bit different, that the insulins went up as you got into insulin resistance. So, in summary, getting back to patients, because most of you are dietitians, fat is okay. High carbohydrate often means low fat and low PUFA. I would emphasize that. And we've already heard this morning and this afternoon about high-carb diets and the problems they can cause. P-S ratio, indirectly, is the only good diet fat predictor for coronary heart disease. In a quick one-on-one situation, when you're looking at someone in a hurry, quickly look and figure out what their P-S ratio is and learn that skill because it's very useful. I can tell you, I'm unanimous in that, as Mrs. Slocum would say. Summary on fat recommendations. Polyunsaturated fatty acids are essential fatty acids, and they're needed for all aspects of regulatory physiology, critical for many cardiovascular functions. Modified fats are bad. Do not consume trans fatty acids. And interesterified restructured triglycerides are suspect until more is known about how they work and why they mimic trans fatty acids at high intakes. Thank you very much.
Questions for Dr. Hayes? Please.
Very interesting lecture. I would like to ask about N6, which is very important for health. However, in the same manner that N6 should be added to our diet, I've been reading many topics about the potential inflammatory effect of N6 that will convert in our body to arachidonic acid, which is could be pro-inflammatory, and shouldn't we balance N6 with N3? I mean, so far we haven't talked, we haven't been discussing the importance of a balance between a ratio between N3 and N6. And as we know, most Western diet is very deficient in N3.
Yeah, no, that's a good question. That's a good question. And we've looked at that. We wrote a review 5 years ago, Annual Reviews of Nutrition. That's important. The amount in grams of N6 a day and the milligrams or grams, if you want, of N3. And the ratio is not so important once you get to the critical mass levels for each. And it's true that they compete for pathways in prostaglandin synthesis. If you put enough N3, you can slow down N6 and so opposite. And I know that Dr. Somopoulos wants us to have a 1-to-1 ratio, which would be totally impractical. You couldn't make a food supply like that. And if you did that, you would have not enough N6 to, correct all the problems we have for cholesterolemia. So the bottom line I like to say is around 7% energy for polys, all right, 7% energy, and then you can figure out how many calories a person is eating and do the calculation and get the grams. Usually it's about 15 to 20 grams of N6 a day, 12 to 20 depending. And for N3, you want to have at least 300 milligrams up to a gram of N3 long chain. That's the way I view that.
Any other questions? Yes.
I'm curious, when you fed the coconut oil, for instance, what form of coconut oil? How was that procured? How was it obtained?
Yeah, we bought a commercial coconut oil, and one that I think it was from a Whole Foods or something of that sort. And then we blend it with corn oil or safflower oil to give us incremental amount of essential fatty acid, so we knew the gerbils wouldn't be essential fatty acid, and blend it and feed it in a purified diet. So we make all our own diets. We put the right amount of protein and starch and vitamins and minerals and so forth.
One other question about the polyunsaturated fatty acids. What relevance do you use in this aspect that these oils oxidize so rapidly and therefore maybe are actually rancid, although you can mask such odors and things?
They're
highly oxidized.
Yeah, that's an important technical question. That's why you don't see lots of polyunsaturates in cookies and so cakes on the shelf, because they can go rancid. They pick up oxygen, oxidize, and they get off flavor, and they spoil the product. And if you feed rancid oil to an animal, there are repercussions. The inflammatory markers go up, the gut is responding, and so forth. So that's an issue if you're going to try and give, drink wheat germ oil, put it on your cereal every morning, and keep it on the shelf by the window where the sun hits it. It'll go bad in a hurry. So it is a consideration. That's why people started bubbling hydrogen through vegetable oils to get rid of, knock out all those unsaturated bonds so they wouldn't go rancid.
Didn't turn out too well.
Thank you.
It sounds terribly appetizing, Casey. Any other questions? Thank you very much.